What you're about to hear could scare the living daylights out of you. I just want to warn you and prepare you so you know. In a moment, Steve Shippey back with us. We'll be talking about his incredible work, his documentary series, his show Haunting in the Heartland, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie back with you. Steve Shippey back with us as well, filmmaker, paranormal expert. Steve is the host of the Travel Channel show Haunting in the Heartland. He grew up in a small town near Saginaw, Michigan, and literally was the kid living in the creepy house on the corner. He was a victim of a severe haunting, actually witnessed several apparitions, and after investigating his own situation, he discovered a shocking truth. The previous owners had been brutally murdered. Shippey has produced and directed countless feature films and documentaries, including A Haunting on Hamilton Street, A Haunting on Dice Road, and A Haunting on Brockway Street. He investigates haunted locations to uncover the truth. Steve, it's a wonder you haven't been hurt yet. Well, welcome back.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Everything good?
Yeah, absolutely.
Gosh, I keep thinking, every time you I see your bio about Saginaw, Michigan, you know I grew up in Detroit. And would get up to Flint every once in a while. It's a great area. Great area.
Yeah, absolutely.
You still have friends up that way?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I'm still in Saginaw.
Was it this episode at your house that got you into this?
Into the paranormal, absolutely. Having that experience and being around the paranormal at that age. And also, I had an aunt that was a really well-known medium in the Detroit area. And obviously from that experience and that influence, certainly.
Now, you've dealt with a lot of cases, and one of them we're going to talk about tonight is called the Gainesville Ripper. How did that come about to you?
Well, I guess to make a long story short, we were approached about taking on this dark case Cindy Kaza and I. And Cindy and I had investigated the Ed Gein case, Ed Gein, the real psycho, and so after Cindy and I took on such a dark case of a notorious killer like that, we were chosen to take on a case once again with another sadistic, brutal murderer that is still said to wreak havoc in the afterlife. So we were brought in to investigate.
Cindy, of course, being the psychic medium that she is, right?
Absolutely.
The case of the Gainesville Ripper occurred back in the 1990s, as a matter of fact. It was a horrible situation in Gainesville, Florida, right, with a fellow by the name of Danny Rawling. He was born in Shreveport, Louisiana, and I'm convinced, Steve, his father created this sickness in this poor young man.
I completely agree. As we uncovered all the layers of Danny Rawling and realized the trauma that he went through, he was essentially tortured as a child, beaten severely, mentally abused, physically abused. And even Danny's grandfather had actually cut his wife's throat in front of Danny's father. So you could see where that awfulness went into Danny's father and then thus into him. And it's generational. I mean, it's just such a disturbing story.
The fellow is Danny Rawling, and his father was a police officer, told the kid when he was little he never wanted him to be born. You're right. He tortured him. And didn't he kill his dog while a little boy was holding it?
Yeah, yes, he did.
Oh, my God.
Yes, he did.
So this kid grows up and does the same thing to people. How many people did he kill? He was a serial killer. He murdered, four or five people?
Actually, it was eight total.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, because, come to find out that everybody really thought that it was the murders in Gainesville that was all that he had done, but he had actually murdered three people in his hometown of Shreveport, Louisiana, and there's a lot of suspicion that there were more victims.
Gosh. Did you uncover anything differently than what some people had already known about this individual?
I mean, definitely we had learned a lot of different pieces of information by interviewing Danny Rawling's fiance, hearing firsthand accounts from her. And what we were really diving into was the paranormal aspect of this case, because there were people experiencing activity in certain areas that they really believed to be Danny Rawling. So that was kind of our primary focus, but at the same time, we were looking to kind of peel back the layers and dig deep into what actually he had done and why he felt that it wasn't him actually doing it, that he believed he was possessed by a demonic force.
He was executed by lethal injection in 2006, and at that point people thought this was the end of him. Maybe it isn't, is it?
You know, I don't believe it was. I don't believe it was.
But these demonic forces that he blames compelled him to murder. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, he had referred to a spirit named Gemini, and, you know, through all of his diary recordings that we actually play in the documentary, some of them, but, he, you know, he recorded countless recordings, drawings, you know, and writing that he believed, and, you know, and told his fiance as well that he was not in control, that something else would take him over. He called this demon Gemini and blamed basically demonic forces for this behavior. That was what he was trying to say.
And when Cindy was on the case with you, what were some of the things she felt?
Okay, so Cindy had said repeatedly that she had never encountered a case like this, and I've worked a lot with her, and what really amazed me was she just kept saying over and over, I've never dealt with anything that is this manipulative. She believed at one point she was definitely talking to Danny, then she felt that she was being tricked. It really affected her severely, and then ultimately, you know, she concluded that there definitely was an inhuman and demonic presence while we were investigating.
I saw a picture of him. He was about 37, 38 years old in this photograph and looked like a normal guy. You know, sometimes these serial killers have this certain look to them. He didn't at all.
Yeah, no, he didn't. In fact, you know, to me, he always seemed like he looked sad. You know, that's kind of a meek individual and always had, you know, sad kind of looking eyes, which is interesting.
What, in your investigation, did you come up with any conclusions?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we started off the investigation in Gainesville, Florida, and investigating the campsite where Danny would hide. You know, he was homeless. He was living in a tent, you know, deep in the woods. But then he would go out at night, and this is when he would target his victims, you know, and do the graphic and horrible things that he did, and then return to this campsite. He would sit there by the fire. He would make his recordings, even record songs, leaving messages to his father and other people, trying to say he wasn't in control. And so we were there. We definitely made contact. We had a lot of hits on our meters. Cindy was picking up on what she believed to be his spirit. And she kind of hit on a couple of things about his inadequacies, if you will, and then that seemed to really aggravate the situation.
How did they catch the guy, Steve?
Well, you know, long story short, he was involved in so many things. In fact, right now I have this huge file in front of me. He was involved in petty theft. He was involved in robberies. And ultimately, it was his behavior in that sense that led the police to go out into the woods there looking for the suspects. And then they ultimately found a tent and realized that these items here in the tent has to be related to the Gainesville Ripper. And some of the other, you know, homeless people that kind of camped out in that area gave the police the information on who he was. And during a robbery, as they were pursuing him, he was caught. And with this evidence, there was no getting out of it. There was no denying it was him.
Did anybody ever testify or say, you know, he was a nice guy or average guy or anything like that?
You know, not necessarily. Nobody really came to his defense in that. You know, he was always known to be strange. And you know, really, when you dig into his past, and again, with all these files here in front of me, I see, you know, so many different accounts. He basically had that serial killer upbringing, if you will. He was, you know, killing small animals, torturing little animals. He started doing voyeurism even in his early teens, watching people through the window. So there were so many warning signs that this man was a ticking time bomb. I mean, you know, it was all there.
What do you think about the demonic excuse as opposed to knowing what his father did to him when he was a little boy?
You know, so I have a couple of different theories on that. I mean, certainly at some point, I do believe he was involved in some occult behavior, you know, as much as I've researched the case. I do believe he was playing around with certain things. That certainly could have been the entry point. But, you know, even beyond that, you have to kind of wonder sometimes if somebody is capable of doing these type of deeds, and he's claiming that he's doing it because of demonic possession. In some way, one could think, could he have actually created the demonic possession by doing it? Because ultimately, he's calling in a demon, giving it a name, and then committing these acts in the name of.
You went to his home in Shreveport, Louisiana when he was a little kid, right?
Yes, we did.
What happened there?
Well, you know, first of all, when we left Gainesville, we felt, okay, we all roads point back to his hometown. We have to go there. We have to get more information, get more interviews, and try to go to this house. We had no idea if the people who currently own the house would even entertain the thought of even talking to us or doing an interview, much less letting us investigate there. We get there to find Sheila Jackson, the current owner, just a fantastic lady. And, you know, we ask if we could speak to her. And
did she know about the history of the house?
She did. She did. To her, you know, it was a house they could afford. They didn't think it was that big of a deal. It was over and done with. She would say the neighbors certainly didn't forget. People wouldn't even walk on the same side of the street for the longest time. And they didn't have any problems. They lived there, you know, for quite some time with no issue. But then she tells us that right around Thanksgiving of 2006, just like a switch, paranormal activity starts happening in their house. And what's interesting about that is he was executed only a few weeks earlier.
October 25th, 2006.
Yes. And then you know, she started to give me a tour of the house. And when she began to tell me what was happening to her and her husband, it was atrocious. I mean, they were being physically attacked.
Wow.
Yeah, it was horrible. So immediately she was asking us, will you investigate? So, of course, we were like, absolutely, and we just jumped right on into it.
Could it have been him in the spirit world?
That, you know, that was my theory to begin with, you know, and as I told her, I was like, you know, I definitely believe you are having these experiences. Let us investigate and try to find out who it may be. It may not even be Danny, because you never know, you know, what you're dealing with on the other side. But it became clear and pretty evident early into the investigation that we thought we were dealing with the spirit of Danny, and it also seemed that there was something else there that was much more powerful than what he could ever be as a human spirit.
It's been 15, 16 years since you were in that house. Do you think she's still in there, the owner?
No, this was recently with Danny Rowling when we were at his house.
Oh, you were? Okay, so you didn't go there right after he died. This was
No.
Okay. Is she still in that house, though?
Yes, she is still in that house.
Why didn't she just sell it and get out of there?
You know, I asked her that, and, you know, and she just told me that, you know, they just simply, you know, couldn't afford to. And, you know, one of the things that she showed me that really shocked me, we were in mid-conversation, and she said, you know, right here where we're standing in the kitchen, this is where Danny Rowling shot his father. And then she points up and says, right there's the bullet hole. And plain as day, there's a bullet hole right through the cabinet door. I reached up, I opened it. You could see the bullet exit.
Jeez.
And everything. And
nobody patched it or anything?
Nobody patched it. It's exactly as it was when this happened in the 90s. It was unbelievable.
Do you think, when you were in the house, did you sense anything?
Absolutely. When I first came in there was a really, really heavy feeling. I mean, you know, you often hear that when you talk to a paranormal investigator. But it really was. It was very stagnant, very dense. The house seemed unusually dark, even though there were a lot of windows with, you know, blinds that were cracked open. You could see that Sheila was affected. You could just tell, you know, she was kind of, you know, on edge in a way. You could tell that she had been worn down from whatever was there. And you just felt like you were being watched. You know, literally. I mean, every room she took me to, it's as if something kind of was following us around.
Did you bring in a Catholic demonologist as well?
Yes, we did. Michael Salerno.
What made you do that?
Well, you know, I've known Michael for a while, and any time that we get into a case that we truly believe is demonic, you know, when we've vetted it to the point where that's our true belief, we try to bring in somebody that could try to bring some type of resolve, and in this case, it was a minor rite of exorcism.
And what did he sense?
Well, as soon as, you know, we basically spoke to him throughout the entire case, and we were giving him all the information about what we were experiencing. And, of course, he's looking for the telltale signs of the demonic. And once we knew and he believed that we knew this is what was happening, we brought him in right away. Right when we walked into the house, you know, he looked at me and said, "Yeah, it's here. You know, let's get down to business right now. Let's get this started."
And is Danny Rolling still hanging out there, you think?
You know, I don't believe so. I've reached out to Sheila recently, and she even left me a voicemail, which actually plays at the end of the documentary, Scream the True Story, and she leaves a pretty wonderful message saying that nothing is happening. You know, but we always know that it's possible to come back, but it's been a few months now, well, actually several months now, and so far it's clear.
How do people see the documentary Scream?
It's on the streaming platform Discovery Plus.
Oh, perfect. Okay, good. How many have you done now, 10?
Well, I've done 10 of my own independent documentaries and 2 of the Shock Doc series for Discovery Plus. The first one was Ed Gein, The Real Psycho, and this one that was just released Friday is Scream, The True Story, because, of course, Danny Rolling's The Gainesville Ripper was the inspiration for the screenplay Scream, the movie.
Is Ed Gein the one who cut the skin off people and would wear it?
Yes.
That's what Silence of the Lambs was based on, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Silence of the Lambs, and the character Norman Bates in Psycho were all inspired
now,
by
it. Was Ed Gein also abused as a kid, Steve?
He absolutely was. He was abused, actually, by his mother, and she was also extremely religious, but, you know, but using...
In a sick way.
In a sick way, absolutely. Not the proper context, you know, and she instilled a dark hatred in him toward women, just all kinds of masochistic type behavior, and again, unfortunately, another tortured soul.
And I guess Ted Bundy, same thing. Something happened to him as a kid.
Yeah, there's no question, I believe, that when it comes to these notorious killers that, you know, that surface, you know, and then sadly part of you thinks how many are out there roaming that have never been caught. But, you know, from the one, you know, but history shows and data shows that there's quite a pattern that seems to be in the childhood.
They seem to be lashing out at the people who abuse them through other people.
Yes. Yeah. And just repeating the cycle, essentially.
Stephen, in your house, when you found out that a couple people had been murdered, did your parents didn't know that?
You know, there was a lot of rumor and innuendo about that, and a lot of different things, and people didn't really want to talk about that. And I just kind of feel that they, you know, much like Sheila and other people that, you know, have a property, they kind of look at it as, well, you know, that it's something that happened, and it's best just not to talk about it. And many people don't consider the paranormal side of things, and you know, and even during that time frame, and sadly even now, even though it's much more common that people are open about it, back then it was extremely taboo.
Sure.
You know, to be saying your house was haunted or you were dealing with spirits.
And this was near Saginaw, Michigan?
North of Saginaw, Michigan. Yeah.
I mean, they hardly have any murders there, right?
Right. Yeah, no, it's definitely not a common thing, but you know, sadly, unfortunately, it does happen everywhere.
When we come back, I want to talk with you about hauntings in general, Steve, and where you think this is all headed. The website I have for you is the Travel Channels. Is that it?
Yeah, absolutely, travelchannel.com.
Super. We've got that linked up at coasttocoastam.com. His Travel Channel show is called Haunting in the Heartland. His doc series, Shock Docs, Scream, the True Story about the Gainesville Ripper, or just a... unbelievable case of a fellow by the name of Danny Rolling. He was born in 1954, and at age 52, he was executed. We'll take your calls next hour with Steve Shippey as we talk about hauntings. Jump on. Maybe you could share a story or a question or two. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you along with Steve Shippey. Steve, one of our listeners sent me a story. You're going to love this. You ready?
Absolutely.
Unexplainable things happened in the Tacoma, Washington house where serial killer Ted Bundy grew up. So many things, in fact, that a contractor hired to remodel the home penciled biblical scriptures on the walls and brought in 2 pastors to bless the house. The contractor, Casey Clopton, said, "I'm not one to believe a lot of this stuff, but this house made me a believer." Gosh, it's everywhere.
Yeah, it certainly is. And there seems to be quite an increase of paranormal activity within the last couple of years, which is very interesting.
Indeed, indeed. Now, what do you think is happening? What what is the other side as far as you're concerned? I mean, you've covered enough of these stories now to come up with your own conclusions.
You know, I definitely have several, you know, different theories. And a lot of what the research shows us with paranormal investigation currently, I do believe a lot of that. I do believe that there is residual hauntings. I do believe, of course, there's intelligent hauntings, human spirit that are trapped here for whatever reason, haven't moved on. And I definitely believe that there is a much darker realm, an inhuman side to hauntings.
Are hauntings all evil?
In my opinion, no. I don't necessarily believe that all hauntings are evil.
But those that are, they're pretty darn bad, aren't they?
Definitely. If something is true evil by definition, I mean, sometimes people will kind of generalize some of these things and they say, well, you know, there's a really nasty spirit here. It breaks things. It trips us. It pushes us. Can pull your hair. Do things to purposely scare the daylights out of you. Now, that doesn't mean that it's evil per se or inhuman. People can be jerks in the afterlife just like they are in real life, you know, the type of person that
sure.
they are. But something evil is a whole different animal, so to speak.
How often do you come across these kind of demonic forces when you do an investigation?
Well, you know, if you would have asked me this about 5-10 years ago, I would have said it would probably be in the 5% category. And sometimes, you know, authentically, without any shadow of a doubt, demonic, sometimes around 2% of these cases. Now I'm seeing more like 25%.
Huge increase.
Yeah, huge increase. Absolutely.
What's fueling it? What do you think?
Well, you know, there's several different theories. I guess one theory that I kind of have as of now, you kind of think, well, you know, these demonic beings like to prey on people's weaknesses, of course. I mean, that's, you know, something that we all know about that realm. And you think about people's mind states currently, you know, you think about what the lockdowns have done and the isolation, the fear, the anxiety. Everyone's just kind of unsure right now what's happening, health with COVID, that type of thing, fear of all of that. There's a lot of unrest. There's financial issues, and I feel that, you know, when things like this happen, it kind of opens a door, you know. And on top of that, a lot of people, unfortunately, are dealing with these situations, you know, with substance abuse and different things, and of course, that kind of weakens the spirit, and that's kind of another door that you can open in that sense. So I do believe that, you know, kind of our current state is only heightening the paranormal realm.
Are you a believer in reincarnation, Steve?
You know, I wouldn't say that I'm not. I'm open to the possibility. I've definitely seen some fascinating cases where, you know, children are being interviewed and they're just describing their past life and people that were in it, and sometimes even knowing, different languages. I mean, I don't know how you explain that. It's remarkable. Is it possible? Certainly.
If it happens, how do you explain what happens to souls like Rawling, for example, Danny Rawling, the Gainesville killer?
Now, in relation to...
I mean, what happens if reincarnation is real? What happens to that soul? Does it get reincarnated, and does it become a serial killer again?
You know, I mean, definitely one would hope not. I would hope that there would be some kind of law, you know, law of the universe that wouldn't allow something like that to take place. But then again, who knows the rules, so to speak. I mean, we all know that energy, you know, as they say, it can't be created nor can it be destroyed. So it really does make you wonder, where does that soul go? I mean, of course, you know, different religions have certain beliefs that it's very cut and dry. You know, somebody passes, they immediately go to judgment, they immediately go where they're supposed to. But, you know, there's many different religions that have many different theories. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's great to have faith no matter what, you know, absolutely. But we don't know everything. We just simply do not have all the answers. And I guess that's kind of where the term paranormal comes from. You know, we see things that we don't understand. And there's a lot of different theories. I mean, there's some people out there that will tell you that anything paranormal is demonic, you know, based on the religious lens in which they look at it through, and that there are, these spirits are just in fact tricking you. Because they have that vast intelligence, and they will make you think you're contacting Aunt Susie or Uncle Bob that passed away in the house, and maybe it's not at all. So there's a lot of different theories, you know, and certainly at different points you have to wonder and question who you may be contacting.
Steve, when you go to some of these haunted houses, do you ever think that you're going to bring these things back to your place?
Well, you know,
they attach themselves to you?
There's definitely a concern, you know, for that situation. And I think I would at least like to hope that everybody who does this always keeps that in mind, that it's a possibility. But there's a lot of different things that you can do. I guess it depends on, you know, your faith system, your belief system, whether that be if you want to be into prayer, cleansing, going to a spiritual cleanser. We all have our different ways. But at the end of the day, personally, I think all of it is helpful, but I think a lot of it's inside you. Going into a home or a location, being spiritually strong, mentally strong, and I think that plays a huge part of it.
Do most of these hauntings revolve around somebody who has died, either in the house or somewhere tragically?
It does. I would have to say, in my opinion, from my personal years of doing this, it seems that more often than not, yes, that is the case. And then there's the other cases that are truly a mystery, you know, just a mystery. You know, you do the research on the house. Nobody's ever died there. In fact, sometimes it's a brand new home, you know, that a family built or had purchased from another family that was 4 or 5 years old. Nobody had ever passed. Nobody has any explanation for how and where this comes from. And, of course, you know, then the theory at that point is spiritual attachment to somebody who brought it home. Then you have to kind of do your diligence and ask some, you know, the hard questions. You know, have you guys been messing around with the occult at all? Have you, you know, mm-hmm. used a spirit board?
Ouija you know, boards, yeah.
Yeah, things of that nature. And then and sometimes they are very honest and, they tell you yes. And then you kind of figure out where maybe it came from. And then sometimes, you know, you believe wholeheartedly that they have no idea what you're talking about. They would never touch such a thing, and you just got to wonder.
Have you ever seen an apparition yourself, physically seen something?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
What happened?
Well, I mean, there's, you know, many, many different accounts. I think, you know, the one that really stands out to me that I'll never forget, well, yeah, it's hard to really forget any of them, but there was an instance once where I was actually, and this is pretty recent, you know, so it's kind of more fresh in the mind, but I was staying at an Airbnb, and, you know, there was quite a feeling in this old house. Right when I walked in, I kind of thought, man, you know, this place seems to have something a little unusual about it, but, you know, I'm not doing that today. I'm just, you know, staying here, and I'm traveling, so I'm not going to be too concerned about that. And about, 2:30 in the morning, I had heard something near the bed, and I kind of sat up a little bit, and I'm trying to think, what is that sound? And I realized that what I was hearing was there was a large armoire right there, and something was kind of playing with the handle, and I just kept hearing it jiggling. So I turned the flashlight on my phone, and I'm looking around, and as soon as I do, I see it move just a little bit, and then it stops. So I'm staring at this, and I'm thinking, there's no logical explanation for this. But I'm not going to try to communicate. I don't really want to do that right now. I'm just going to try to go back to sleep, wake up, and get back on the highway. Well, about 30 minutes later, I heard something in the adjacent room. So this time I got up and I turned the corner. And what it looked like to me was kind of a very fast-moving, wavy form that seemed to kind of have its own light. Now, I would say it was transparent, but not completely. But it looked more like a partial apparition. And then it just literally shot across the room. And before it went to where the wall was, it just kind of vanished. And this room was pitch black. So it was kind of astounding to see something that was emitting its own light.
Until you moved into your house as a youngster, were you a believer in these things?
Well, you know, I was so young at the time that I didn't, I really didn't have a belief system, in any way, I guess you could say, when it comes to something like this.
Were you glad to get out of that house?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, absolutely. I definitely was. But, you know, but it left me with a fascination to find out, you know, what it was. It's very interesting when you're at that age and you see that your family, your parents specifically, are going out of their way to tell you that that's not possible. These things aren't real, and then
you don't know what you're seeing or anything like that.
Right, and then when you see a crack, you know, and you realize at one point, you know, everyone comes to the table more or less, and now it's out in the open that they do believe. You know, that really shifts your mind at that point, because you're like, okay, wait a minute, you know, this, you told me this is something that couldn't happen, but now you're saying that it is. Now you're admitting that it's happening. So at that point, you kind of start to question everything. You know, your whole mind kind of opens up to, you know, what you think is not necessarily what it is. You know, and that just kind of led to a fascination for me.
Your co-host, Cindy Keza, the psychic medium.
Yeah.
What does she say about these things? What does she think they are?
You know, I really don't know her theory, you know, to that sense. I mean, typically when I work with Cindy, you know, we are right into the case, and she's tuning in, whether it be through remote viewing or, you know, several other tactics that she has, and she's tuning into the energy, who's here, you know, why, what do they want, that type of thing. But, you know, but I would be very interested to hear, you know, her theory on the afterlife, I guess, in general.
I mean, there's definitely something happening here. There's no question about it.
There's no doubt. I mean, you know, in poll after poll, they do it every year, and actually the numbers actually increase. The most recent poll, and you typically hear this stuff around Halloween where these large news broadcasting, you know, they're always kind of putting something, I guess, you know, Halloweenish, so to speak, in the media at that time, and they always poll adult Americans. Who believes in ghosts, essentially, is the question. And the most recent poll was around 54% of the adult population. Now explain that to me. You know, 50%, actually over, but half of the adults in the United States that took this poll believe in ghosts. How can you possibly say, I mean, what would you say? That was a mass hallucination? And this, and, you know, in talks about spirits and ghosts, this goes back as far, you know, as text exists. You know, as far as man has written down their experiences, there's always talks of the spirit realm.
If you had an opportunity to interview Danny Rawling prior to his lethal injection, the serial killer we've been talking about, what would you ask him?
You know, I think, number one, I wouldn't allow him to deflect the blame of the things that he did. But I would definitely ask some very hard questions to him about this demon, as he called it, this spirit Gemini. I would want to know, can he describe this entity? What would this entity tell you? When did it first come into your life? When did you start having these urges? I would be wanting to know more from a paranormal standpoint, asking certain questions to really try to figure out, is this something that really came to him, or indirectly did he conjure something by literally manifesting and doing these evil deeds in the name of evil, which will certainly conjure it.
And what do you think triggered him? I mean, he was, what was he, about 36 years old when he started the killings?
Yeah, you know, I think what triggered him was the things that took place in his past. I feel that, you know, like, for instance, let's talk, you know, about the voyeurism. Imagine, you know, a kid's 12, 13 years old, and he's going around the neighborhood, and he's peeking in windows and watching people through their windows. Now, his ex-fiance had an explanation from Danny, so we're getting this information secondhand, but basically directly through her, that he was doing it in a sense because his family life was so bad and so terrible that he would go just watch other families just living their life, watching the TV, eating dinner, trying to live vicariously, so to speak, to have some sense of that. But then somewhere down the road, perhaps as he grew older and you know, and different things take over, that voyeurism took a much darker path, which of course we know now is leading into how he's known to be the Gainesville Ripper.
Unbelievable case. Just how they're created and made, though, is something that psychologists, I guess, and psychiatrists just jump into, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, there's no doubt that you know, the research clearly shows, you know, and not always, once in a while there is just a shocking case where a serial killer is discovered and they can't really seem, you know, like Jeffrey Dahmer is a good example. There was no abuse in that case. You know, his father's, you know, couldn't understand where this came from. You know, he was never beaten as a child, but yet he exhibited all the traits of a classic serial killer as a child. Now, I think, you know, personally, the abuse that Danny suffered, it mentally damaged him. And beyond that, he was beat horribly, and even beat as an infant. So you got to wonder, could there have been some brain damage? You know,
well, that's
some,
true.
You know,
that's
yes,
possible.
Perhaps frontal lobe damage or something that also completely changed his mind. And you got to wonder if that's, you know, a possibility.
Do you think it was that fight with his father in May of 1990 that triggered the murders later?
I definitely do. I think, you know, when he had gone as far as to go to that level of violence and then actually, you know, the murders in Shreveport, you know, he was believed to kill three people in Shreveport, Louisiana. At that point, I feel like for him, there was no turning back. I feel that typically when individuals like this, when they cross that line, they can't go back. You know, once they draw blood,
that's it.
It's a compulsion, you know, that they can't stop feeding.
Steve, we're going to take a break and come back and take an hour of phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.